what is an algorithm and all of its components, including the ones that are often left out in casual descriptions, like proof. And we've given a couple of examples of nifty algorithms. They're both search algorithms, such as binary search and sequential search. And we've talked about the issues of proof for those algorithms, you know, prove they're correct and so forth. So we've established the baseline for those algorithms. All the required components, I claim, we've talked about now. The body, the asserted outcomes, the assumptions, and the proof. And the proof is always the following theorem. If the assumptions hold, and we go through the body of the algorithm, then the asserted outcomes are true. That's always the theorem that has to be proved about any algorithm. And so now we're going to go to the optional phase. That is to say, it's not, you don't have to say how efficient an algorithm is to make it be correct and usable. But nevertheless, it's often very desirable to know what the cost of using a given algorithm is. Cost in terms of computational time and or space in particular. And we use the notion of computational complexity to do that. At least, so first we're going to talk about the computational complexity of just functions. And then we're going to show how that applies to algorithms. Okay? So you kind of have to just separate yourself from algorithms for a minute. Make your mind a blank. That is to say, get a clean slate. And let's talk about functions. So the kind of functions we're going to talk about are defined on positive integers, or most of them anyway. And they got real values. Floating point values. And this is just propaganda. We're going to define these things independent of any finite number of initial values, constant multipliers, and try to have lower order effects not be part of the equation. So what we got is three different concepts: big O notation, big omega notation, and big theta notation. We've got to define what they mean. Okay, so big O. We say that G of N is less than or equal to big O of F and F of N. G and F are these two functions that we want to compare in some way. If there exists positive constant C and N naught such that 0 is less than equal to G of N is less than or equal to C times F of N for all N bigger than N. What we say is G is asymptotically bounded above by F, when we see that. Let me draw a picture on the chalkboard to try to illustrate that. Suppose that we had two functions, f and g, graph of g. I'm going to draw the graph like a solid line, even though we really only need it over the integer values. The graph of g, let's say, looks like this. Well, that's g. And the graph of f looks like that, f. Well, as for large values of n, what you can notice here is that the graph of g for large values of n is less than the graph of f. for those same large values. So what that shows you is that G of n, let's say, there's n naught here, where those two graphs intersect. G of n is less than or equal to f of n for n bigger or equal to n naught, okay, whatever the definition says, bigger or bigger than or equal. So this would be an illustration of two functions where G is asymptotically bounded above by f. And asymptotically kind of implies that we're willing to ignore the early going and only care about the tail, the infinite tail, how to behave. So the n naught is kind of, that defines the early going that we're willing to ignore. And we're just saying that beyond that, f of n is dominating g of n. And we even have a constant in there, do we not? And we allow ourselves to multiply f by constant as well. Here, of course, the constant would be 1. Now, let me explain the intuition behind the n naught and the constant c. The n naught, so the n in general would represent for algorithms the size of the input to the algorithm. The size of the input. The constant would represent some notion of efficiency of the language translated to a machine. So you've got notions of different efficiencies. I might code mine in C and run it on a supercomputer, and you might code yours in BASIC and run it on a desktop machine. Well, I'm going to have an advantage because I have a really efficient language that produces high quality executable code, but also I'm running it on a faster computer, let's say. The constant C is to take that advantage away. So if you're F and I'm G, you get to multiply me by a constant of 10,000 if you want to compensate for the fact that I'm running on a faster machine. So now the N naught means that I'm willing to ignore smallish sizes of input. I care most about large input sizes. And in a way, that's a way of ignoring the startup cost of an algorithm. So if you've got one algorithm that has to define 10 variables, 10 local variables and initialize them and maybe initialize a bunch of other things, and it's got a fairly complicated conditional inside that has to be checked, well, overhead for that algorithm is going to be greater than an algorithm like sequential search, which has essentially only one local variable and almost no initialization. And so for very small input sizes, like search range of 2, sequential search is going to beat binary search just because the main cost is all the initialization you got to do to get the local variables. And so that's what the N naught is for, is to allow you to ignore very small sizes of input, because there the dominant thing is the overhead cost of the algorithm and not the actual looping cost of the algorithm, if you get my drift. So that's where the C and the N naught come from, and it makes it machine independent and independent of computational overhead issues like that. Now notice that I have here, we call it G less than or equal to O of F. And I use less than or equal to here because it's to help you remember that it's it's like a numerical less than or equal to relationship. Big O is. Big omega is a very similar statement, except that it uses bigger than or equal to instead of less than or equal to. So notice that in big omega, I have g of n is bigger than or equal to the constant times f of n for all n bigger than or equal to n naught. And I say that g of n is bigger than or equal to big omega of f of n. So that's sort of like g is bigger than or equal to f if they were numbers. So I've got a notion of less than or equal to, a notion of bigger than or equal to. And big theta is, big theta is the notion of equality. And it kind of combines both into one, because you have two constants, C1 and C2. And again, an initial integer. And you're going to say that C1 times F is less than or equal to G, but that G is less than or equal to C2 times F. So note the constant C1 kind of comes from this definition, and the constant C2 kind of comes from this definition. So it's the two definitions combined. And what we say is that G is equal to theta of F. And the phrasing would be G is asymptotically bounded above and below by F. Or you could also say G is asymptotically equivalent to F. And you can prove stuff about these things. You can prove, just give you some examples here. Transitivity. If I say it as though they were numbers, it'll be intuitively obvious to you. If f is less than or equal to g, and g is less than or equal to h, then guess what? F is less than or equal to h. If f is bigger or equal to g, and g is bigger or equal to h, then f is bigger or equal to h. And finally, if f is equal to g, and g is equal to h, then f is equal to h. There's also a kind of anti-symmetry. If f is less than or equal to g, and if g is less than or equal to, I'm sorry. I was thinking about something else. If f is less than or equal to g, then g is bigger than or equal to f. That's what that's saying. And for numbers, you know, that's standard stuff. And turns out you can prove that in this notion of relationship to among functions. That's anti-symmetry is the kind of thing that works for inequalities. For equality, you get symmetry. If f equals g, then g equals f. And finally, reflexivity, a function is equal to itself. So f is less than or equal to itself, it's bigger than or equal to itself, and in fact, it's equal to itself, basically. And here's the one I was thinking about before. You also have this notion of dichotomy. If f is less than or equal to g, and g is less than or equal to f, then f is equal to g. Now, all these are discussed in significantly greater detail in the textbook for COP 4531. Where these notions, as you continue through computer science, these notions get used more and more often, and you need to get more and more familiar and comfortable with using them to describe things. And here's the way it relates to algorithms. you want to state the complexity of an algorithm in terms of one of these things, big O, big theta, big omega. You want, this will make it independent of hardware and independent of programming language, which is good. And here's the way you do it. You let M be some measure of the size of the input to the algorithm. In a search algorithm, N is typically the size of the search space, the size, the number of elements that you're having to look through. In a sort algorithm, it's the number of items that are going to be sorted, for example. Number two, find an atomic notion of computational activity to count. Now, what do I mean by atomic? That means kind of indivisible at some level, indivisible at the level of the language you're dealing with. So a function call to another complicated algorithm would not be atomic. That's a big molecule, that's not an atom. But something like a single assignment statement or a single comparison is atomic. Okay? So they're like single statements in the language, for example. Non-compound, but simple statements in the language. Then you count the number of atomics done by the algorithm as a function of the input size. And that gives you a function F. Okay, that function F, the complexity of that function is the complexity of the algorithm. So let's look at an example of how that works. Here's a for loop. So here's your, suppose I had three things going on in this for loop, three simple statements in this for loop. And those would be atomics. This loop runs from 0 to n, so the loop body executes n times, right? Does three atomic computations in the loop body. So the complexity would be 3 times n, because that would be your function. And then I have this mysterious equals theta of n. So why is theta of 3n equal to theta of n? Let's look at the definition of theta. Okay, suppose f is n and g. No, I'm sorry, so G is N and F is 3N, let's say. Well, I can let C1 be 1/3. 1/3 times 3N is N, which is equal to N. And I can let C2 be 1 if we want, because N is less than or equal to 3N. So by just taking C1 equal 1/3 and C2 equal 1, I see that this definition is satisfied with G being N and F being 3N. And so F and G, 3N and N are asymptotically equivalent. And you know, basically that's like saying, well, if I'm on a supercomputer and you're on an old desktop, it's going to take you 3 times as much time to do the same algorithm as it will me, but we don't count that in asymptotics. We count that as being the same, because we don't want it to be dependent on a particular implementation. So that translates to theta of 3n being equal to theta of n. Now, you very, very quickly realize that that means it wasn't necessary to come up with three atomics in this loop. All we really needed is one. And count it, right? So the fact that theta of, you know, things like this are true allows you to not count everything in the loop body and still get the right asymptotic class for the algorithm. And so what quickly develops is the art of keying in on one kind of atomic that you're going to count that's easy to count, and count that, and don't worry about the other atomics that go along with it, because they're just going to add to the constant multiplier. Now here's a loop with break. So suppose I have, and this is reminiscent of the loop defining sequential search. I've got something I do here, and then I have if condition, and then I break out of the loop. What's the complexity of this loop? Well, the best you can say is that its complexity is less than or equal to big O of n. The problem being that, in the worst case, if this condition is never satisfied, you're going to run through the full loop n times, and you're going to have an atomic counted in each, or three atomics in each run, so you get 3n, which is equivalent to n, asymptotically. But the problem being is that you might, if this condition is error evaluates to true, you might break out of the loop early. And presumably this condition is dependent on the values of the data that's input to the algorithm. So there's no way to predict what that condition will evaluate to in advance. And so you can't say that this will always run n steps. It might run fewer than n steps. And so that's the case where the best we can say is that it's asymptotically bounded above by n, but it might be quicker. So that's kind of the distinction about why we need big O sometimes and why we use big theta at other times. Clearly, if you can make a big theta statement, it's the best kind of statement to make because it gives you precisely what the runtime is. But sometimes you can't do that and you settle for big O, as in cases like the loop with the breakout. If you have a loop and then another loop, there might be three atomics in the first one, five in the second one. Each loop runs n times. There's no early breakout. The complexity is going to be 3n plus 5n, which is 8n. But again, 8n and n are the same, whether you're talking about big O, big omega, or big theta. And so we can make this statement. This statement is true. The complexity of this algorithm is less than or equal to O of n. Now people are always writing to ask, well, why isn't this theta of n? Well, it is. You could also say the complexity is equal to theta of n. That would also be a true statement. Because there are no early breakouts in these loops. They're not going to terminate short. They're always going to run to completion. So I could say the complexity is equal to theta of n. I could have said that. I think I'm going to go and put another bullet in this slide that says complexity equal theta of n. And then put down and say both these statements are true. Okay. What you find in the literature is that often people settle for big O, which is kind of like it's no worse than this. And it might be better. Here's an example of where it's no worse than O of n, and it might be better. Here's an example of it's no worse than an O of n, and it isn't ever any better, but, you know, it's still true that it's no worse than O of n. Nested loops behave in a more complicated manner. Suppose your outer loop runs n times. You got a couple of atomics in the outer loop, and then you have an inner loop that runs n times, and some atomics in there. We're counting these things up. The inner loop runs 3n times, right? The outer loop runs 2 plus that 3n times each trip through the body, so that's 2 plus 3n. But it runs n times, so you have a multiplier n there. So you end up with 2n plus 3n squared. Now, why does that reduce to plain old 3n squared? Well, that's something that's worth taking a look at. So you'll begin to begin to understand how easy it is to simplify your runtime. The thing. So what have I got there? 3, what is it, 3m, 2m plus 3m squared. What I want to do is compare this to m squared. Now I'll do it by dividing the two, just to give you an example of how things can be computed. So what is, look at that quotient. I want to rewrite this in a rather strange way. I'm going to divide both the top and the bottom by m squared. One over n squared divided by one over squared. Right. Doesn't change the value of the quotient. Now, multiply this through, and I get one over n squared times 2n, which is 2 over n. And one over n squared times 3n squared is just 3. And then downstairs, I get one over n squared times n squared, which is 1. So what I get is 2 over n plus 3. Well, for large values of n, what is this? For large values of n, 2 over n is a very small number, so this thing is approximately 3. So as the n gets bigger and bigger, this thing converges to just plain old 3. Now, what that tells you is that the growth of these two functions has got to be the same. That tells you that the growth of these two, I won't say it again. The growth of these two functions has to be the same because if the top ever started beating the bottom, this would grow infinite. If the bottom ever started beating the top, then it would grow to 0. So the fact that it converges to a positive number tells you that the bottom and the top are asymptotically equivalent. And there's a theorem about this. And that theorem is proved in the algorithms text from the next course. And that says that if the limit n going to infinity of f of n over g of n is equal to a positive constant, some constant greater than 0, then theta of f of n, well, then f of n equals theta of n. In other words, then f and g have the same sort of asymptotically equivalent. Now, I don't want to go into it any more than that. It's actually not that hard to prove, but it's not something I want to get into right now. It's not a deep, mysterious fact. Just a little algebra and using the definition of limit would do it. Here's another example where I probably could have said theta instead of O and equality instead of less than or equal to. If I'd wanted to, I just chose not to. So here's a simplified version of sequential search, where notice that I've got a Boolean variable called found, and instead of early bail out of the loop, I'm just setting found to true when I find it. Okay, so the loop runs to completion and I return the value of found. Found is initialized to false. It never gets changed to true unless at some point t equals item, in which case to change found to true. So our notion of input size is going to be the size of the container, the number of things in the search page. Atomic computation will be a call to that, the thing will count as the call to that equality operator. That'll be our notion of atomic computation. So our runtime function will be one comparing the loop body times the number of iterations of the loop body, which will be one times n, and that, so that's just n, and n is theta of n, transparently. So your algorithm complexity here is theta of n. It's theta because there's no early bailout in this simplified version. It's simplified, and but it's not as quite as efficient as the other. Sequential search, not simplified. You actually do the early bailout by returning true. And here the analysis goes something slightly differently. The n is still the size of the input range. The atomics are still calls to the equality operator, but your f of n is less than or equal to one comparing the loop body times the number of iterations in the loop body, which is one times n, which is theta of n. The point being that sometimes f of n is less than that first thing, depending on the data that might get you an early bailout returning true. So the algorithm complexity here, the best you can say is that it's less than or equal to O of n. And finally, what's the algorithm complexity of binary search? For example, the lower bound algorithm. Well, again, your notion of size is going to be the same, the number of values in your search range. But again, the atomic computation will be a comparison operator, but in this case, the less than operator. And so f of n is one compare times the number of iterations of the loop body, which I claim is one times log of n, and therefore we get theta of log n for the asymptotic runtime. So let's note carefully here. The best we could say for sequential search is less than or equal to a big O of n. Best we can say for binary search is that it's equal to theta, big theta of log n. A log n is a whole lot smaller than n, so this is much, much sped up from sequential search. There's one little thing that's perhaps not completely obvious, and that is why the number of iterations of the loop body is the logarithm of n. I gave you the intuitive answer to that. I mean, if you take a number and keep dividing it by 2, how many times do you have to divide it by 2 before the number becomes less than 1? And I'll leave it to you to verify that that is the logarithm base 2 of the number. And notice I didn't really specify which base logarithm here. And the reason is that the logarithm with respect to one base is a constant multiple of the logarithm with respect to a different base. And so it doesn't matter which logarithm function you use because they're asymptotically the same. Because one's just a constant multiple of the other. So you can interpret it as base 10 or base 2 or whatever. Okay? So finally, the t-vector retrospective. Last week we talked about the t-vector. You get constant when you have runtime complexity O or theta of 1, we call that constant runtime. That's the best you can do. That's the best possible runtime if your goal is speed. Let's look at these things. For example, popback. If you recall, all we do to implement popback is decrement the size parameter. So that clearly just takes a constant amount of time independent of the size of the vector. Clear, we just set the size parameter equal to zero. That's all we have to do. Front just returns the index zero element. Back returns the index size minus one element. Empty returns, will test size equals zero and returns true or false based on that test. Size just returns a size parameter, and capacity just returns a capacity parameter. All those things are just a couple of lines of code that don't have anything, any loop in them, and are independent of the size of the vector. Let's skip over the second one and look at runtime complexity theta of n. The constructors, destructor, display, and dump have runtime complexity equal to the capacity, theta of the capacity of the vector. And why would that be? Why when you construct a vector, is that a theta of n operation? This has to do with operator nu. When we build a vector, we run operator nu to request a memory block the size of the capacity of the vector, right? When you run operator nu, what happens is, first, there's a low-level memory allocation block of the right size. Step one. Step two, the type T constructor is then run for every piece of that block. And that's to guarantee that this is a block of T elements in that memory allocation. So the operator nu does two things, a low-level malloc from C, followed by a loop and a call to the default constructor for type T for every one of those blocks, every one of those T footprints that got allocated. So that is a loop, and that's an O of N, a theta of N operation. A simple call to operator nu with a bracket is a theta of N operation. And by the same token, delete, the bracket delete is a theta of N operation, because what happens is, first, the type T destructor is called for every footprint in the block, and then the memory is deallocated. Calling the type T destructor for each element in the block is a theta of N operation. That's a loop that has whose size is exactly the capacity of that memory block, the number of T footprints in the memory block, and so it's a theta of N operation. There's nothing you can do about that. Those are going to be theta of N operations. And then set capacity and set size and the assignment operator will typically be theta of N, but sometimes they might be less costly. For example, in the assignment operator, most of the time you end up having to delete the memory assigned to the receiving object and rebuild it for the incoming object. But occasionally the receiving object has the same size as the incoming object, and you don't need to go through that. You just do a actually, even then you have to do a copy, so you still have a loop of size n to run through. The one case where the assignment operator has nothing to do is the case for self-assignment. So if you assign a equals a, that turns out to be a no cost, constant cost operation. And similarly for set capacity, in the cases where you are asked to set capacity equal to the same capacity that you already have, there's nothing to do and it'll be constant runtime. But if the capacity is actually changing, then it'll require that amount of effort. And similarly for set size. So set size, if if you set the size to something less than the capacity, then you're just moving the size parameter to a different value. And that's constant time. But if you set the size to something whose capacity that's bigger than the current capacity, then there's the timeout, memory deallocation, memory reallocation process that you have to go through, which is a theta event operation. So I think that explains everything except the pushback having amortized runtime complexity theta of one. And I haven't explained that, and I won't have time because I have 2 minutes to get to my appointment. But the first thing I have to do is explain to you what I mean by amortized runtime. And the second, then I have to prove to you that that's a true statement. We will take that one issue up at the beginning of the next class next week. It will be a good opportunity to kind of refresh everybody's memory on what all this stuff means. Okay. So that's the one last thing to do, is prove that one. We'll do that first thing next week. So now y'all are going to take an hour slight break combined with